right, Luff Reckoners, welcome back to this Sunday's bonus episode. We're really excited, Matt and I. How are you doing, Matt?
I'm doing well, David.
Matt and I are really excited to be joined by C. Derek Varn. You can find their work at Varn Vlog and also a recent piece up in Sublation Magazine, which I've also written for on Burned Out for 2024. We'll put links down below for y'all to find that. But thanks so much for joining us today, man.
It's nice to be here.
Well, I think that we could have had you on to talk about a hell of a lot of things, and I think we'll probably touch on a lot more than just the general subject matter. But I want to bring you on to talk a little bit about the right and its trajectory right now, because I think that that's something that is very much under-theorized by a lot of people on the left. A lot of people spend their time fixating on, you know, criticizing liberalism rightfully. But I think that sometimes you can forget the monsters on the other side of the room, too, when you overfocus on that. But, I mean, maybe just to give people a sense who may not be familiar with you and familiar with your work, you know, could you give us an understanding, you know, about your own history with the right wing?
Yeah, sure. I am from Macon, Georgia, and as I talk to you, my southern accent will come back, actually.
Oh, yeah.
It'll be interesting. My listeners aren't used to it. And that's relevant actually in a couple of ways, because when I was in my teens, I grew up very poor, then slightly less poor. I was raised by a single mom for a little while. She got married when I was about 5 years old to my stepdad. My stepdad's a great guy, mechanic, Ross Perot fan, Reform Party advocate, that sort of the political milieu we came out of. My mom was a very conservative Democrat, just kind of to piss off her mother, who was a very liberal Republican. Her mom was Catholic and an anti-racist, relatively speaking, for, you know, the deep tidewater South in the 1950s and 60s, but was a conservative Republican in every other way. So when I say liberal Republican, I mean she was like pro-market, distrusted racialist politics, resented, always complained about Nixon and the Southern strategy. But she would call FDR communist. Mm-hmm. Which, you know, as a communist, I find insulting, but, so that's where I came from. And while I had a pretty interracial family, actually, the milieu that we were in, I mean, Macon, Georgia was a shit place to be in the mid to late 90s. It was a mill town in the 70s and 80s. It was a tobacco packing town until the mid-90s, and then when Brown and Williamson left, the only thing really holding the city together was the fact that it was about 45 minutes away from an Air Force base, but didn't get most of the military Keynesianism, so to speak. And Geico was there. So that was it. Mm-hmm. Was the third largest city in Georgia. I think it's like the eighth now. It's last 25 to 30 years has been pretty much steady decline. And that in many ways reflects a lot of red state America. I mean, like, life expectancies have gone down, populations have gone down in these areas. These kind of mid-sized southern midwestern western cities have been highly decimated by the last 10 years. And so my response to that, I came out of kind of a punk scene, actually. So I had kind of countervailing forces in my life. And a friend of mine who was a little bit better off and got me really interested in the anti-globalization movement. And that could cut either way now that we know, like, it's actually funny. People often think about that time period as like a heyday of horizontalist anarchism, and, you know, when like Michael Albert and David Graeber were really making their name. Mm-hmm. So we go out to Seattle. I'm a Southern boy from Macon, Georgia. I had spent some time in Canada because of my biological father, but for the most part, I spent most of my life in either Augusta or Macon, Georgia, mm-hmm. or and either mostly black or mostly ex-urban communities. Or I had spent it in the Maritimes in Canada, which itself is a very poor part of Canada. So I went out there and met all these activists. And my response, because I really didn't understand wealth yet,
mm-hmm.
You know, if you're a lower middle class working worker kid, when you think someone, you know, if in 1990s money, you meet someone whose parents make $60,000, you think they're rich. Mm-hmm. So I met all these kids and activists in their early 20s in Seattle. I also saw all kinds of speakers speak, from Micah Albert to Pat Buchanan. Pat Buchanan just seemed more serious to me than a lot of the kids I met at the Battle for Seattle. They thought that they won that battle. And when we left and we drove back to Georgia, which was a long trip, I just kept on thinking like, nah, they didn't win shit. But I hadn't completely flipped. And then I spent a little bit of time homeless, and then got into college. So I come from basically being without a place to live and living on people's couches, and for a little while even living on the street, to getting a HOPE grant. So people who don't know that, HOPE grant is like a scholarship you get in Georgia from the lottery, and to go to college. And so I move in with a friend and go to school. And my response to going to school was conservatizing. Hmm. Why was it? I wanted to be a science writer. Mm-hmm. That was my ambition. And I wanted to work in like National Geographic journalism. Now I was entering in the late 90s where all that shit's about to fall apart. My grandfather, and both my uncles, were Korea or Vietnam War vets. And so I have a distaste for war in the military. I grew up exposed to it. I have in-laws that were in the military during the Iraq War. I taught at a military academy. I worked at a prison actually too in this time period. So I was exposed to that side of the world, and I hated the war. But when I would go and protest with these leftists after the Seattle thing, they kept on leaving a taste of unseriousness in my mouth. The horizontalism didn't really speak to me. I've nuanced on that. Actually, I think there's good things out of that, but the way it was presented to me and the way like this joy in activism was presented to me, they would talk about, it just seemed like you were setting yourself up to get beat up by the cops. And I just thought only dumbass rich kids would do that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm going through school and I go to protest the G8 at Sea Island after 9/11's happened. So this is right after 9/11's happened. And International Answer is there, and they're being jackasses. And antiwar.com people are there, and people around the Libertarian Party. And they are being serious. And everybody else didn't go. A friend of mine actually, who said he was going to go with me, actually ended up going to see one of the first Suicide Girls Burlesque shows in Atlanta. And I was like, this is how unserious this is. Now, honestly, now I think he actually might have been spending his time in a better way than me, but at the time it seemed like a betrayal. And these paleoconservative anti-war types really got to me. I got pulled into communities of them on LiveJournal. They seemed to be more sincere
mm-hmm.
in their opposition to the Iraq War, because they didn't give any Democrats, and most of the Democrats had supported it, any flack. Mm-hmm. Whereas the Democratic anti-war people were kind of turning themselves in knots to justify what people like Joe Biden and Senator Clinton back in those times had done.
Mm-hmm.
Or that Hillary, I mean, or that Bill Clinton had actually begun actions that would lead up to it too himself a couple years before W. I mean, there is so much that we forget now. There was two things that really held me out of that milieu. It was very, my family is very Jewish and Catholic, and I am technically Jewish, ethnically. And so I could pick up on hints of anti-Judaism in Buchanan early on. And then as I got further and further in it, I came across Joe Sobran, who was a paleocon writer who got kicked out of the National Review for being too racist, like John Derbyshire did years later. But I didn't realize he was his racial views, or more specifically his views on Jewish people. And I was reading his blog, and he went on some kind of rant about how Jews were responsible for communism and like the deaths of so many thousands of good Orthodox Christians, which I found interesting, interesting in a kind of scary way. And then a lot of people around me, they moved from people like Murray Rothbard into people like Julia Savola. And this is way before this becomes mainstream stuff. It's kind of around Pharaoh House culture too, if you remember Pharaoh House Press. So it's a very like art heavy alternative culture. And so it seems very progressive. But a lot of those people were fascist adjacent, even in the late 90s. And so I was enmeshed in that culture as well. So I was on the outs because I wasn't that religious. And I was being a little bit freaked out by the racial implications of some of the arguments. But I will also say in that time, people, even though I think it's a far more conservative time, people were much less likely to let their racial shit be known. So Richard Spencer, for example, I was telling you guys off air, I had this weird email exchange with him about Adorno, actually, when he was, I guess this had either been right, been why he was still the arts editor for AMCOM magazine. So I guess it's around 2005. And I'm beginning to break away from this, right? Because I also think their economics don't make sense, right? This Ron Paul stuff that a lot of them push. And then this new nationalism stuff that they were pushing before it was called that, just didn't seem coherent to me.
And was that from the get-go? I'm just curious about the economic side of that right-wing movement. If there was any appeal up front, or if it was something that you got into and then start to deny later as you learn more about it.
I got, actually, I would say I was never a totally free market guy, but I used to think that, nations could economically plan. And this is actually quite interesting because a lot of my views weren't that different than say social democratic views about the relationship to like national development, trade protectionism, stuff like that. That was my position. And what's weird about that is that's come of age now. That was a very minority position on the right in this time period. I have also broken from all that for reasons that are about, from studying economics. Because even though it is true that nations actually have always engaged in economic planning and there aren't markets, without government involvement, basically, I mean, like that's a little bit more complicated than that, but, the idea that you could do a total like national revivalist and have like good corporations who are loyal to your nation state come back and be employed. That's something that I just realized wasn't viable. And that and the housing crisis, which I wrote an article predicting in 2005, which go me, I wrote it in a literary journal, actually, which is weird.
Well, that was the problem there, friend. Right. There's not people who own all the houses.
Right. Well, actually, at the time, they might have owned houses because it was real damn easy to get them. I was actually inspired by the fact my brother, who didn't have a job, was able to get a home loan. Now, the house was only like $70,000, but I was like, he doesn't have a job.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how does that work? And they lived in an area, South Central Georgia, where there really isn't jobs. So I was like, huh. And then I started doing some research and I was like, why are they building all of these big houses in places like Macon, Georgia, where there's not jobs to support that? Are they what would possibly drive that kind of development? And while I did not know about mortgage-backed securities yet, I did kind of glimpse that it was mostly investment. And I was like, this doesn't feel sustainable at all. It's a waste of land, for one thing. And so I wrote this article for this little literary magazine called Unlikely Stories. And I then just started doing more and more research, first into neural Rabini and Keynesian economics, which I ultimately ended up rejecting by about 2006, then into heterodox Keynesian economics, and then into Marxism, which I thought had the most robust theories of the business cycle. Mm-hmm. Now, I know most people don't become Marxists because of the business cycle, but it also explained what I saw in my own community.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the levels of exploitation that I saw there, and the fact that despite all the privatization, that no one could get ahead, so that was sort of my journey through the right. I was big on the right wing of the anti-war movement, and more than I was on anything economic. And even back then, there was weird stuff that travailed in those circles, like AIDS denial was common, and that really got to me because my aunt had AIDS, although she didn't die, but she had a car wreck. And I was already beginning to see signs of the opioid epidemic really hitting my community. And so all that together, and then I became a public school teacher in the Deep South and mostly in a 50-50 black, 50-40-10 black white school. And there's just certain shit you can't deny when you work in that sector, unless you're going to double down and deny the trends that you see.
Totally.
So, I would be helping, a lot of young black men try to go to college, and I would just see them not succeed at all. And then I started also thinking about all the trailer park white kids that I taught too, who had similar problems. And it wasn't IQ. Yes, there are statistical IQ deviations between wealth groups, which I later learned from reading more stuff, can be explained by stress levels. And you just looked at these outcomes and you were like, and you meet these people and you're like, no, this is not because they're not working. And I also kind of knew this. My mom busted her ass. She was a waitress until I was 18. She became a prison nurse. Like I said, we both worked in prisons. That was another strangely conservatizing element. For me though, you'll be surprised. I was a conservative prison abolitionist. I say this as a joke, but even from working in a prison for 9 months, I decided that it was more humane to literally cane people than it was to put them in prison. So I kind of took that response for a while. Like, we should bring back corporal punishment and get rid of prisons. I was a complicated conservative, but I was on that side of things. And,
No, I'm just saying it's interesting here because, I was born in 92. So, a lot of these things, were sort of preceding me, like the late 90s, early 2000s movements. But I think about a writer who I read a lot and really respect Alexander Coburn, and was really important for me, at least, moving from like the right to the left. And you see the way that he's writing about like antiwar.com and like the libertarian movement at large there. And it seemed to have had like a little bit of a different feel than it might today, for folks, you know, particularly like people who were on the kind of radical anti-war left, not really having a lot of political allies, especially in the media. You know, there was an like a sort of fascinating little fusion that was going on in that period of time.
Yeah, I would say, I mean, Coburn's a figure that I actually have complicated feelings about because he was too soft on certain people.
He gets that a lot for sure.
Yeah, but I think it depends on your, I think a lot of people's feelings about Coburn is whether or not you moved from like a soft right position to the left or whether you moved from a harder right position.
Mm-hmm.
Because he was really good on Bush, mm-hmm. On, actually, my God, I was talking to a liberal friend of mine who comes from an upper class background, and he's a teacher, and he was going off about how Bush wasn't that bad and how Trump was a Russian stooge and mm-hmm. how Biden wasn't that bad. And I was like, and then he told me that he had met George Bush once at a fundraiser. And I was like, I think I know everything I need to know about why you think Biden's, because you're economically removed from the consequences of the decisions. Mm-hmm. You're not from a community that was highly affected by the war. Whereas
mm-hmm.
my community, in Central Georgia, you had two ways out. You could go to college and then hope to move to a bigger city. Or you could enter the military. That mm-hmm. was pretty much it. There was not there was not many other paths out of Macon, Georgia.
Totally.
For you. And, you know, I mean, I would tell people about this. I'm like, you know, don't judge this by your income, you know, because I know a lot of people on the left, this is a stereotype that's actually, I think, fair, are income poor, but they come from middle class or upper middle class families. And they're like, oh, I lived with my parents for years. And I'm like, well, you could do that. If I live with my parents, I'm living in a 3-bedroom house with like 9 people on a couch. Like, it's not the same.
Yeah, that's not been an option for me either. No, yeah, exactly. Very different. When you're thrown into the world, that's a very different experience, you know, is knowing that the other side is probably, it's not going to be a soft landing.
Yeah, and so, like, the whole hustle thing was different. Like, and there is a sense of, like, one of the things that I've always told people is if you come out of the poor end of the working class, if you actually get out of it, you actually do make that class jump. Now, that class jump now doesn't pay off like it used to, actually. I can go into that, too. But you actually do make that class jump. You're actually primed to be conservative because of survivor bias. Because you got out of it. For me, I think the only reason that didn't happen is that my parents wanted me to be an artist because they wanted their kids to basically do whatever they wanted. And they thought they sacrificed a ton so that their kids could, but they didn't really know how impractical that was.
Hmm.
So I ended up being, I got, my first thing was, I told you, to be a science writer. Well, I realized about 2 years in the entire journalism field was about to collapse. So then I just switched over to English and philosophy. Now that seems impractical, but my goal was actually to be a lawyer. Then mm-hmm. I worked for an insurance company for a year, which took all the want to be a lawyer out of me. And I was like, fuck it. I'm just going to get a degree in what I like. So I got an MFA in poetry. That did have an effect. I think sometimes leftists, we always tout the benefits of education. And I think there are a lot of benefits to it. I can focus and read now. Like, there's no way I could have otherwise. But there's also a downside to that. My first wife was, you know, from the same social class as me, and my peer group became more and more alienating to her, and it was a major strain on our marriage. And in fact, I used to talk about this a lot when I entered grad school. All kinds of social classes were in grad school. So I will say that it wasn't just upper middle class kids. It was mostly that. And I should say kids, they were 25, but it was mostly that, but it wasn't all that. What you saw a lot of the time though, is it was completely destructive to marriages and other relationships. The amount of work, the amount of social infighting, the kind of training that inculcates in people. And that was the other thing that made it hard for me, even as I became more left-wing in my ideology, to deal with leftists, because they come out of that world where those academic norms, which often do not privilege relationships, do not privilege solidarity, despite sometimes privileging feeling for the oppressed, are doing the right thing.
Totally.
It was amazing how many people thought it was weird that, like, I didn't, for example, go to a better school because I couldn't easily travel with my spouse. And they're like, well, you're 25. Why are you even married? Basically. And I was like, okay.
Yeah.
And you know, it was a major stress in the relationship. Eventually one of the reasons that the relationship died. But what I was about to say is every person who entered that program, eight of them came coupled. 3 years later, one of them was coupled to the same person.
Mm-hmm.
It's destructive to those kinds of relationships. It's destructive to family life. It's not designed for it. It's actually very harsh on women. Education, the culture of education is very female forward until you get out of undergrad. But then in grad school, it flips and it's just brutal because you're not supposed to have a family life. You're not supposed to. The social competition is all encompassing. So I struggled with whether or not to identify with the left because I identified them with a certain class of people who were not me. Now, it's not that most working class people were right wing, even when I was growing up. Like I said, my family was a conservative Democrat and a Ross Perot supporter. It wasn't like they were good Republicans. It was more that, in so much that they were Democrats, they didn't pick up the same activist talking points or anything that were common.
Totally, totally.
You know, and it just didn't, it didn't speak to them at all, you know, so.
No, and that stuff is just incredibly alienating. And, you know, from my experience, like a lot of mirrors, at least with the social stuff, like growing up working class, like for me, it wasn't as long or like, as in depth, I mean, it was very surface level, but it was just sort of this realization that I had, like, oh, all the rich people around me seem to be Republicans. So maybe if I want to be successful, like that's the ideology I need to follow. I always hated the racialist stuff. I was really resistant against that. So I guess I was sort of like some kind of wishy-washy libertarian, but just showing like how surface level it was really when I would hear the critiques of like the welfare state, being somebody who grew up on food stamps and things like that. Didn't make a ton of a lot of sense to me, or the fact that, you know, people were talking about work ethic a lot. And as you were mentioning, it's like I grew up with a single mother who worked her ass off my entire life, her entire life. And, you know, that never really sat right with me either. And it was really, I mean, for me, it's just a funny point that I try to remind people on our side is you never know what might pull people over to your side. For me, it was like those kind of silly t-shirts I remember seeing at Occupy that were things like, do you like the post office? Do you like the fire department? You're a socialist, right? And now I wouldn't say that that's like the best argument for what socialism is. But for me, it was like, oh, yeah, actually, these social programs are good and they're positive. And it was like one of those things. And then when I went to school and I was able to get educated by reading Marx, and Rousseau was really big for me, actually. Early on, like it was just like a couple weeks process for me, my political trajectory. But like, I do have to say, like looking back, a lot of my right wing stuff came out of a real frustration of like talking, particularly to like wealthy liberals. And, you know, I'm from Austin, but we moved from middle school, high school to South Carolina. And there's also this weird thing where you'd have like wealthy like Yankees who had moved down there to basically retire, and they don't care about the community or anything like that. And there was this really kind of snidey, you know, wagging your finger at folks. Oh, well, these Southerners are so stupid. That's why they're all Republicans. I'm from New York City. I'm a liberal. And just having a very visceral, like, you know, reaction against that, too. But I mean, I think we have like a pretty solid baseline to actually like fast forward a bit to today and to start to build out this kind of framework, because I'm curious what you think about, you know, these kind of concepts like right populism. There's some of the newer variations, which I think we should get to in a little bit later. But, you know, maybe starting with Trump as maybe a kind of breaking point or a big movement point in the right wing. I mean, how would you sort of categorize the state of affairs right now? I mean, just like to be really clear, like here's something about Trump that I always remind folks. I was 100% wrong on Trump's popularity. When Trump first announced, I said, you know, the folks like the last thing that like Southerners want is to vote for a rich New York billionaire. And I was dead wrong on that. They, you know, despite hearing all the things I heard growing up, they're very quick to forgive him for that kind of cardinal sin. And I think that it speaks to, you know, some of the interesting nature of like Trump and Trumpism. But I'm curious what your general thoughts are on that.
Trumpism is fascinating to me because it is both a shift and it isn't a shift. Mm-hmm. What I think we will see in the future, that there was a major change in the right due to Trump, but it won't be exactly from Trump. Kind of like, I mean, if we'd had a Bernie Sanders presidency, I suspect we would say the same thing about Sanders. Mm-hmm. So what do I mean by that? Well, Trump was a rich Wharton grad, you know, elite, but he's also the poor person's idea of what a millionaire is.
Just on that really quick, I just like, again, so I went to a really poor high school, one of the worst high schools in the country on like academic standards, extreme poverty, all that kind of stuff. And I'll never forget, they took some of us, and I don't know how they calculated it, but it seemed like it was all the people from my neighborhood and not the people from the nicer neighborhoods. And they put us in these kind of like, you know, computer science classes so that we could learn some basic technology skills. Anyways, our teacher there, obsessed with Donald Trump, a huge Trump poster. And she was always like, Trump is a perfect businessman. If you want to learn how to be successful in this society, like you need to like follow Trump's lead. So I'm just like, you're 100% on with that caricature.
Well, and just look at how much he's mentioned in like culture, right? Like rap, he is synonymous with rich guy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so it also depends on when you come into the Trump milieu. I actually, even from like a poor Southerner who just went to college standpoint, Trump was kind of a joke to everybody when I was coming up, because in the late 90s, he was known for the junk bond scandals. Mm-hmm. This was before The Apprentice. It's before his like cleaning of his image. But one thing I noticed about Trump early on, I actually wrote about this, is he could come off as a, quote, anti-political figure in a way that most Republicans couldn't since the Goldwater Reagan synthesis. And one of the things about the Goldwater Reagan synthesis is I think some people overestimate the effect of Reagan. But Reagan codified these things that were small shifts that you even saw in some of the incoherence of the Nixon presidency. Now, I'm not that old, thank God. But I grew up in Reagan America. That was America that I felt. And I remember, you know, and it says a lot about, you know, the social attitude. We had a mock election, I think I was in third grade, and it was between Dukakis and George Bush Sr. And George Bush Sr. won that classroom election. Now, Georgia was still a Democratic state into the year 2000. I know people don't, they forget that. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's been such a forgetting of what this was. But these were populist Dixiecrats too. So while Zell Miller did do the Hope Scholarship, or the Hope Grant, which I just mentioned earlier, which is, you know, if you have a B average in Georgia, your tuition is remitted by the state. It's paid for by the lottery. It was also like race baiting was definitely part of the Democratic strategy then, in race baiting and the anti-black direction. Mm-hmm. While you could trust like the Black Congressional Caucus to play ball with Democrats. They all were Democrats, even in the South. That was pretty much left up to the cities. And there was this whole Dixiecrat operation that literally overnight in like 2000, when Sonny Perdue won the governorship, when Bush Jr. was coming up, they literally just flipped their names from D's to R's. Like they just changed overnight. They didn't even elect new people. Right. So these were like Strom Thurmond Democrats, basically. Mm-hmm. But they ran Georgia, but you could tell that the atmosphere was that it wasn't that Democrats were particularly hated. It was that the national level Democrats were seen as rich outsiders, and we just weren't going to vote for them. Mm-hmm. Like, and it, I mean, it shows up, and I say this is a third grade classroom we're doing this vote. We're just reflecting the attitude of our city, right? Totally, and our parents. Totally. Like, this doesn't say anything about our political life. We don't have one. We're tiny. But I remember that profoundly, remember laughing at that because, you know, how quick people turned on George Bush because he couldn't carry that semi-populist sort of thing. It's been interesting to think about that political trajectory in the South. Like the Midwest was solidly blue. I think what Trump really did is that the voter base of Republicans statistically has been mostly what we would in Marxist circles call petite bourgeois, small business people, the chamber of commerce people, and the titans of extractive industry. All right. And that really shifted under Reagan. Finance plays both sides, but does tend to actually favor Democrats. And that was also true. I realized that when I worked for Geico, because they would lobby all the time. And they're lobbying both sides, but they spent more money lobbying Democrats than Republicans a lot of the time. So you had this feeling that like the individual wealthy were probably going to be Republicans. And then the really, really wealthy were probably Democrats. And if you actually look at the Pew stats, that wasn't actually that true in the 80s and 90s, but it is true now.
Mm-hmm.
It's this weird thing where like the stereotype has become the reality. And Trump speaks to that because he speaks to the aspirational feeling of a lot of people in the United States. He speaks to a lot of their racial resentments, totally, but he doesn't do it in a way that just speaks to racial resentments. And that's one of the reasons the left has had so much trouble dealing with him. But what Trump didn't do when he came up in 2016 is while he tried to place a bunch of paleoconservative and Steve Bannon-esque wackadoos in the key positions, some of whom actually have more humane positions on things like war, to be honest, the Republicans still stonewalled him, and his inability to be loyal to any faction meant that he purged most of those people within the first year and replaced them with more standard Republican operatives, are people who were just loyal to him and had no ideology whatsoever. The problem that the Republicans have right now, and what I would have said would have saved them if the Democrats had not screwed up as bad as they have, is that what Trumpism is beyond loyalty to Trump remains unclear. It is populist. It is isolationist. Is it pro or anti-war? Well, listen to a Trump speech and you'll get both things. Mm-hmm. I was actually talking to Scott Horton, the libertarian of anti-war radio, and he was pointing that out to me. Like, Trump appeals to everybody on the right in a way that no one has even since Reagan. Because if you listen to a Trump speech, he will throw out pro-cop and anti-cop sentiments, pro-war and anti-war sentiments. You're listening and you're only zooming in to the parts that you like.
Mm-hmm.
We'll even throw out pro-racist and slightly anti-racist, or at least what we might say inclusive nationalist sentiments. And again, if you're any kind of right winger, you have something to glom onto unless you are a technocratic neoconservative. And that's the shift.
Well, no, I think that lays it out fairly well. But what's interesting is, like, I mean, first of all, like, I think Trump as a candidate and as a force is different from Trump in office, because as you were saying, like, the fascinating thing about Trump is, like, Trump's presidency was just like Republican Party autopilot policy for the most part. But what's interesting is to see the rest of the right and the GOP in particular sort of lining up around him. Like, I remember very vividly, like, during the 2016 Republican primary, some guy harassing Ted Cruz towards the end of the race, calling him Lying Ted, Lying Ted, Lying Ted. And in that video, the guy actually, like, comes at Ted Cruz from, like, an anti-ish war position, because Ted Cruz is like, well, Donald Trump's horrible to women. And the guy says, look, we supported the Iraq war that killed a whole bunch of women. And it was like a really fascinating moment. I remember thinking, it's like, well, I wonder if there's going to be like some kind of material shift here. And now you look at it, you know, it's 2022 now. And, you know, Cruz is still able to maintain his popularity. He's seen as somebody who's close in some levels to the Trump project. Like, a lot of people who are anti-Trump early on, it's not even just that the thing is, like, people focus too much on the personal relationship between them and Trump, and not what their relationship then becomes to the voters, because that's where, like, where it gets more fascinating, right? Yeah, of course, Ted Cruz, slimy guy, Trump insults his wife and he sucks up to him, despicable person. We can judge him as an individual on that. But what Cruz has been able to do is, despite being outside of that movement initially, now is seen as, like, you know, a champion of the cause. And I think, I'm curious what your thoughts are on this, but I think one of the things that's really interesting and important for us to be able to recognize with Trump is that what's happening, I think, in, like, this moment, 2022, is now you're seeing all these movements to try to theorize Trumpism and populism and become, like, the next directors who can, like, lead that energy, right? I think from people like Cruz to, like, the Teal Boys and Vance and all those guys, this new kind of, what are they calling it, national conservatism now?
Yeah, the national conservatism, yeah.
You know, and I think that is, like, the if you want to find something to focus on that actually matters the most materially for our politics in the immediate future, and I think longer on too, it's like, that's the struggle that I think on the right that's the most interesting and important.
So one thing I would say is that Trump in opposition is more powerful in a lot of ways than Trump as president, as far as the way it's going to shape the Republican Party. Not only do you have, I mean, there's a lot of other trends that we need to look at. Trump consolidated the evangelical base, but he also did it by the fact the evangelical base is basically dying. Between secularization and age, the evangelical base is a smaller and smaller portion. And because of things that they did during Trump, a lot of people left those churches. So it had this perverse effect in concentrating down the kind of ideological loyalty. It probably won't serve those churches very well in the long run, but they did get the deal that they were hoping for, which was evangelical, sympathetic Catholic, usually ironically, judges appointed to key positions, so that the culture war stuff can be promised on. And one of the ironies of this is that for regular Republicans, there's no longer a disincentive to give these people what they want. And let me explain that to you, because this should also make people cynical about dealing with Democrats. If you have a highly motivated single issue base, the last thing you want to do, if they're going to be loyal, is actually give them what they want, because it will disperse their loyalty. Right. Hate to tell people that, because it's probably why you only get Democrats talking about Medicare for all when they can't really pass it, because you want to make a push and then not deliver on the policy. Well, now, between that and relative birth rates, which I don't mean to get all conspiratorial, I don't think the average Republican sees the benefit to keeping that out there. There may be people who try to pass a national abortion ban once the Supreme Court does what it's likely going to do. That probably won't go through even a Republican Congress. Now, I say probably, because who knows? You should never underestimate this stuff. But I have been actually thinking about the likelihood of Roe v. Ray being reversed. And I was like, yeah, as soon as actually a Republican's not in office, it, and they have that Supreme Court stacked the way they did, well, now would actually be a time to actually deliver on it and earn the loyalty of those evangelicals while they're a small but then hyper-dedicated part of the base. The other thing that really changed, and I think people who are younger than 35 don't grasp the significance of this, is Republicans have always talked Jesus and give you Ayn Rand. Well, mm-hmm. both those things have really stopped. That part of Republicanism is dead. They can't do that anymore. There's going to be no moral majority bait and switch for Ayn Rand objectivism. The Paul Ryans of the world always saddled these Republican populists with things that are very unpopular amongst even their base because it affects their material interests. Trying to reverse Medicare and privatize it. Trying to get rid of Social Security. You will notice under Trump, that's gone. Mm-hmm. They're not doing that anymore. What they have figured out is something that hasn't been figured out since the Reagan period, but it's fought on a new way. So during the Reagan period, because what Reagan learned from Nixon was you can dog whistle and throw racist stuff into the public discourse and homophobic stuff into the public discourse, but then also do some small community development stuff to as kind of cover. Now, Nixon was much more sincere about that. For all of Nixon's personal racism, he also, and the Southern strategy, he also did a lot of black developmental politics to try to, I mean, it was basically throwing seeds into many different strategies to see which one would stick. Are you going to get the racist or are you going to get a black community? You know, he didn't really care which one. By the time you get to Reagan, it's clearer which one's going to be more loyal. Between the fact that the John Birch Society had used civil rights as a crypto-communist plot for years in right-wing circles, and that had kind of slowly eked out into the popular consciousness, they had set all that up. And what's ironic, actually, during the 70s and 80s, these right-wingers, particularly from the Goldwater movement forward, explicitly studied a far left and soft far left, so Leninist and Al-Kalinsky organizing methods. The John Birch Society was set up on Leninist cells, explicitly, with democratic centralism as its, which is hilarious, actually, because its whole goal is anti-communism. And I remember sitting with a conservative professor of mine in, I think this was in 2002, which was right after 9/11. And he told me to read Rules for Radicals by Saul Alinsky. And he said, we use that to put Reagan in office.
Yeah.
You know, and it doesn't actually, ironically, doesn't really work for left-wing stuff, funnily enough, but it does work for right-wing stuff. So they have a better understanding of us and a more realistic understanding of our flaws than we often do of them, because particularly since the internet, everyone wants to fight the Nazi.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody was throwing everything as if MPI, National Policy Institute, and Richard Spencer and the alt-right were going to be the people who they were really opposing, that the Proud Boys and Gavin McGinnis were going to just run the streets. And while I do not think that there was no threat of that, even then I was like, well, why aren't you studying 3%ers? Because I've known about them for a long time. Why aren't you studying American fourth position? Why do you not know about the real attempts at red brown infiltration? Now, unfortunately, also when I say anything about red brown stuff, we have to also deal with the fact that liberals have weaponized that for a decade,
mm-hmm.
right? To discredit all leftists as, you know, horseshoe theory crypto rightists. Red brown mm-hmm. stuff is very, very rare, but it is real. So you have all these things kind of happening at once. While at the same time, you have this national conservative movement, which has even been reaching out to Marxists who are disillusioned with liberals and offering them money, a platform, and a platform that, while I would not take, I don't always blame people for taking it unless they go on agreeing with the National Conservatives. If they come on there agreeing with them, then I consider them traitors. But they've been setting this up for a long time. Now, I'm going to say something slightly controversial because I hear this a lot on the left, that we don't have money. We do have money. We do have money. We have, like, we've supported an entire media ecosphere. The amount of left money in NGOs is actually kind of staggering. We don't use money in the same way. And one of the things I can say about having been in the right-wing ecosphere, even though I wasn't part of this elite version I'm about to talk about now, but I've known people who were, is they will take working-class and middle-class kids. They will get them into specific programs in universities. Mm-hmm. They will get them jobs. They will, those jobs will pay well. They will not be hyper-exploitative jobs. If anyone's ever worked in left publishing pays shit. Now, mm-hmm. to be fair, because there isn't a lot of investment money in it. There's just not. But that's not true on the right. And so during this time period, there's been a lot of religious and not evangelical institutions. So the things that people have thought they've been fighting was, until 2016, everybody thought they were fighting basically the evangelicals and the moral majority from the 90s.
Yeah.
After 2016, they all think they're fighting the alt-right and the people who showed up in Charlottesville, which, again, was a real threat, but was never the primary threat,
mm-hmm.
right? What was really happening during that time period is places like the Claremont Institute, First Things Magazine, etc., were figuring out a way to make paleoconservatism more viable than it was from the Pat Buchanan days in the mm-hmm. 90s up through the American Conservative Magazine days in the aughts, where it was part of the anti-war conservative coalition. And to return some of that vitalism they had against Bush. But now, under Trump, they're no longer in opposition. Mm-hmm. And you even see this in the most fringe parts of the right-wing media sphere, like QAnon and Alex Jones. They're used to being in opposition to the mainstream of the Republican Party. After Trump, they're actually an extension of it. Mm-hmm. That's new. That is new. And between that, and then you have this high end of this, is what I'm talking about, the Claremont Institute, with a highly rigorous intellectual core that has been building up people for 2 or 3 decades. And they now have something that they can devote themselves to. And if you are a disillusioned millennial who are a younger Gen Zer who's tired of war and is watching the Democrats screw up over and over and over again, it's going to have an appeal in a way traditional conservatism absolutely does not.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the shift that's happened under Trump.
No, I mean, I think it's interesting. And, like, you know, within that whole apparatus, it's like, I'm curious about what you think. This is a broad question, so let me give a couple of examples, maybe. Somebody like my governor, Governor Greg Abbott, is like a very interesting right-wing figure, because this is somebody who's been around for a while. But he's been a very much like a political chameleon, right? So when Bushism was like popular in this country, he was your typical like Texas Bush guy. And now he is, you know, trying to be Trump's favorite governor, but Trump keeps on throwing treats toward Ron DeSantis instead, which is a little pathetic to see Abbott groveling so much on it. But the point still stands, right? It's like, this is somebody who has achieved incredible amounts of power, right? And then the question is like, well, what is the intention of gaining that power for yourself, right? Other than, you know, maybe you could just be a purely motivated by just, you want to be the big dog in the room guy. But you have somebody like that versus some of these other characters like Hallie, Vance, which I think represent a different kind of synthesis with the movement, because they're willing to push back in some interesting ways, and never really, like, it's never a hard break, but they push back against, like, the Republican Party writ large. And then you have guys like Huckabee, who, you know, is just, other than being a horrible comedian, is somebody who has, you know, seems to have completely devoted himself and his life and his family to the personal pleasure of Donald Trump, right? Like, I mean, for the people who are in power and benefit and then end up getting to make decisions from this kind of system, my question is twofold. It's like, is it cynical in the sense that, like, they're willing to just ride whatever train seems to be viable? Or do they have, like, a very specific end goal, you think, in mind, you know, for their politics and the future of the country?
I think it's a little bit of column A and a little bit of column B, and it really depends on which group you're talking about. Mm-hmm. So the governors, I think they have the interest of finally breaking with some of the unpopular neoliberal stuff that the Republican Party has been known for from Reagan to George Bush too. The issue that they have, and the issue that's interesting, and I want you to, like, look at the states where this is happening, all right? Because this is actually telling. In the safer conservative states, now what you have is, like, when I live in Utah, mm-hmm. it's like 80% Republican. It's actually more like 70% Republican, but the way it's districted, it's 80% Republican. There are effectively two parties here. Outside of Salt Lake. Salt Lake is a Democratic stronghold. They're both Republican.
Yeah.
You know, you have mm-hmm. the Romney Republicans who are aligned with the LDS Church and with moderate developmentalism, and still a little bit of that neoliberalism, actually. And you have the Mike Lee Trump Republicans who were even willing to leave the LDS Church because the LDS Church took a positive stance on vaccines. One of the things that Trump has had to deal with, though, is his movement has gone far beyond him.
Mm-hmm.
Trump is interesting because if you were to put him on paper and put his policies on paper, he would actually seem like a 90s moderate. That is true. That's one of the fascinating things about him. People forget this. He had a kind of scammy stint in the Reform Party as the anti-Pat Buchanan candidate, ironically, mm-hmm. In 2000. That whole clip with Trump from the People Think the Simpsons Predicted the Future with is actually from that time period. So, no, they didn't. The scammy part of that is that, you know, basically that was right after the jump bond scandal, and people were trying to figure out if he was trying to dump a whole lot of assets and clean his assets up with that run. His positions haven't changed that much, except they've gotten more and more racialized. But the racialization, I will say, with the exception of the attack on Mexican immigrants, well, even maybe that, if you are not listening for dog whistles, you can plausibly deny it. And that's the thing that I think liberals really don't know how to deal with. The other thing that I saw that was a bad sign that we talk about Trumpism a little bit, is when in 2001 they were talking about, you know, a non-white nationalist, about all the fact that there was like a large Latin and Asian leadership mm-hmm. core to a lot of these far right patriotic movements. And I was like, yeah, if you guys have been reading American Affairs magazine, you would have known that they've been pivoting from racial nationalism to integralism and corporatism, which, by the way, are fascist concepts, but they're fascist concepts before Hitler. Mm-hmm. They have a tradition in the Catholic Church explicitly. And they talk about stuff like workers' dignity. All right. That has not been part of American conservatism, but if you if you, this is where my Canadian background helps a little bit. Like I said, I lived in Canada for a very little while. I was a kid, less than a year. But I knew about the Progressive Conservative Party, which sounds crazy, but they were a red Tory movement, which is a kind of conservatism that in America has been hard to justify because it's a settler colonial state. And so blood and soil nationalism with a strong welfare state for people born there was hard to justify. You can kind of see this in like some of the undercurrents of racial politics around people like Huey Long and some of the Southern populist tradition, but I don't want to tar them too much with this because a lot of them were also true leftists on a lot of issues. But that's a real tradition that is largely absent, with an exception of a very minor strain of the Dixiecrats, in American political history. What Trump's intellectual milieu has done has figured out a way to take that kind of Catholic corporatist view and have people from the center, Michael Lynn, who's claimed to be both a liberal and a conservative, depending on the time period, is part of this, and the right construct a kind of nationalism that cuts against what the Republicans have been saying the entire time up until Trump. Now, this movement is not the movement of street Trumpists. And what people have missed and haven't been paying attention to is what this national conservative movement has been doing is filling in the fact that Trump didn't really have an ideology. They had a counter-systemic movement with nothing to fill it in. And stuff like QAnon and whatnot is not going to appeal, not just to non-intellectuals, it's not going to appeal to young people either. Even though conspiracy movements have high pervasiveness, there's a natural limit to how much influence that stuff can have. It's also too erratic. You can't control it. So this national conservative movement has been trying to come up with a way to tie an intellectual high church Christian, okay, and I'm going to talk about what I mean by that, but high church Christian method to also distance themselves from the moral majority and the Christian populism and the Pat Robertsons of the world that dominated the other end of the Republicans, the non-libertarians, for the last three decades, since the late 70s, definitely during the 80s. And everyone has kind of known in the right, and this was even true when I was on the right, the Reagan coalition has been fraying since Bush, since Bush Jr. Nothing's really replaced it. The libertarians have liquidated themselves into various parts of the nationalist movement for the most part. If you see like, it's almost sad. I almost feel like I'm defending like old fashioned libertarians now because it becomes so rare, and they are good on things like the cops and the war. So, you know, every now and then I'm like, I kind of miss those guys, even though they're total shitheels. At least, you know, there are at least things about them that I could respect. With the national conservatives, it's actually going to be harder for us to deal with. Because if you're a soft leftist, but have any inclinations towards civic nationalism, closed borders, anything like that, they have talking points that can pull you over. And many of them are willing to work with leftists to do it.
I think quite explicitly a lot of them are like inviting it.
Right. Now, I saw that also during, like, again, I got pulled into the right. Culturally, probably was primed for it, but also because my experience of like liberal leftists in the late 90s, early aughts, which I think for the American left was the objective worst time in history. Yes, there are plenty of, but it was a time where like it was only appealing to a very specific subset of people. There are some other trends that I think this speaks to, if you want to talk about demographics of Destiny and stuff like that, that I think it throws people off. One, the leaders of the national conservative movement, by and large, are not white. Two.
Wait, on that, I mean, it's hard to like think of them all in a room together because it is very dispersed, but...
I mean, the whitest one would be like...
the majority are non-white? I mean, I would still say that a decent amount.
The leaders. I think like, it, just like if you've ever watched the Republican National Convention, there's like five black people that get shown over and over and over again. They have made sure to recruit. And this has not just been, you know, people started noting this with like a lot of the nationalist movements who weren't explicitly white nationalists, like the stuff out in Portland and Idaho. The Proud Boys increasingly had non-white prominent members. But what you started seeing when these journals, like First Things, you started seeing people with like South Indian and explicitly non-white names. And there's been a lot of outreach done to like Catholic churches in South Texas, rural churches. There's been a lot of outreach done to black men, particularly over their seeming emasculation. Well, not seeming, their actual emasculation through, you know, Southern white policies, but tying that to the LGBT movement. There has been a lot of speaking. I mean, this is something that I was talking to my partner, who's, you know, an activist. And we were talking about, well, what are they saying about the LGBT movement? And, you know, of course, all the horrible things. But then I said, but they're also saying something else about, you know, if you listen to the Marjorie Taylor Greene into this, that's a distraction. And by the way, this has been a Republican tactic for a long time. And it's usually specifically a woman. I don't know why. But you find Michelle Bachmann was one of these people. Sarah Palin was one of these people. You find a female figure who's willing to say outlandish things. And it's generally to a middle class, to a middle age, not middle class, or middle class too, to a middle age and middle class, mostly white audience will read as attractive. And you let them go off. For some reason, it's catnip to liberal and leftist journalists. And they will spread that.
Sorry, I didn't hear you well.
Oh, it's catnip to liberal and leftist journalists.
Okay, yeah.
And like I said, for the past two decades, it's always been a woman. What that does, though, is you hear the most outlandish end of that stuff from her, and you focus on that. What you don't hear is Josh Harley saying the rest of the story. So they're talking about, well, there's a future where everyone's queer. And what Josh Harley's going to say, it's because masculinity has failed. And you think he's talking about the manosphere, and he's not. What he's actually saying is because we have screwed up economically because of these liberal policies, you don't have a future. And the reason why everyone under 25 is polyamorous, queer, and being groomed into this is because they also, there's no possibility for them to have a family economically and socially. So why would they try? Therefore, masculinity is dying. Therefore, all the kids are queer. And that is the part that most people aren't hearing. I actually listened to a Josh Harley speech to hear this. So we hear the Marjorie Taylor Greene outlandish thing. We send our people after that. We don't come up for an argument about like this isn't happening because the decline, because the family's declining for economic reasons. But then again, if we did attack that, and we're Democrats and not, you know, leftist first, we have the distinct problem of the fact that Democratic policy has not helped aid in any of that. Totally. And this is also where I get kind of mad at upper middle class liberals and say, well, why don't they vote their interests? And I'm like, when do you deliver on their interest anyway?
Yeah.
The thing is, people did used to, like, working class people did used to vote for Democrats. It was the largest part of the coalition. By 2020, that is absolutely no longer true. The net wealth of Democrats is above the net wealth of Republicans now.
And I mean, no, it's something that, I mean, maybe we could take this a little concrete. Like, I've been trying to raise the alarm for a long time about what's happening in South Texas, because you have seen, you know, these Republican gains. And I think it's important, one, to like temper our amount of alarm about what this means, you know, to also remember like the facts, like, you know, a lot of these counties, and for example, they vote for Biden, but they were counties that Hillary, you know, that Obama was winning by like 30, 40 points that Biden was squeaking by with 10, 8%. Right. And like, mm-hmm. that's significant. And when you talk to a lot of liberals about it, particularly liberals who aren't familiar with Texas, one of the first things you get from people, and always pisses me off, is this like, well, they're not real. And when they're talking about like Tejano Hispanic voters, like, well, they're not real Hispanic Tejano voters. They've transferred over into something new. And it's frustrating because, one, you're denying people just like their basic like identity, right? Which I think is just absurd on its face. And two, are refusing to interact with your own kind of belief about what race, or even on some level with Democratic, with the Democratic constituency at large, like class means for which way you vote. Because as you're saying, like when they go, oh, why are you voting for your interests? It's like, well, you know, you can't make these arguments about the South, right? And not talk about New York City or California and look at the reality of what like prolonged periods of like liberal rule have done for working people in those communities too.
Yeah, they basically run them out of the state where like you're either very, very poor and you're too poor to leave.
Mm-hmm.
Or you've gotten out, even if you were culturally, you know, so much so that it's caused havoc on the property values in half the country. Now post COVID, there's 1,000 other things causing havoc on it. You know, we can't just blame California. That's a scapegoat. But the thing is, and if you point this out to California liberals who are fairly economically isolated, they get defensive almost to a person. I have had a problem with this. When I told you, I was around 2004, 2005, I'm coming out of this right-wing period. But every time I'd see these stupid Jesus land.
Yes.
You remember these memes?
The first episode of Left Reckoning was dedicated to like just attacking that thing. Just so you know.
It comes up every 4 goddamn years.
Yeah.
And now it's been 20 years I've seen that stupid meme. But what
I want to say, Midler, when she was talking about West Virginia people, and like, sorry, not to fixate on this, but like, it infuriates me for many reasons. Like, even if there wasn't all this history, right, it would infuriate me, but it really infuriates me on when you think about the history. Like, New York City, right, has been a magnet for capital. And where's that capital coming from? Exploitation that is happening all across this country and all around the world. So the material deprivation in West Virginia flowed into New York City and created, you know, this town that has access to a lot of, you know, culture and money, frankly, and education that aren't available in other parts of the country. And it's not because, oh, the people in the rest of the country are stupid, right? And like, they have something wrong with their soul. It's like, y'all have taken all the shit from them.
Yeah,
and now we're like wagging the finger at them and not offering them anything, by the way, on a national political level. Yeah, it's absolutely infuriating to me.
That one and the other meme is like, well, we pay for the stuff and they don't, you know, like we pay more on our tax dollars to the federal government than the southern states.
And that's the price that you have for a centralized currency. Like, you have to have that.
Right.
Like,
well, the other thing I'd point out,
what happens when that doesn't, when you don't do that anyway.
Do you know what the southern states are getting for that? They're getting military bases.
Yeah.
Like, that's what they're getting for that tax. They're not getting, like, and they're getting, and in the case of the Midwestern states, they're getting farm aid. But they're not getting, like, welfare. That's, mm-hmm. like, that's,
yeah.
that's the ridiculous thing. And I'd be like, I would point this out to people and I get pushback all the time. And this was back when I was more willing to play ball with Democrats back in the day. And I'd be like, look, you're literally A, saying Jesus land is the most of color part of the country mm-hmm. in aggregate outside of, or totally. Outside of like, you know, specific boroughs in New York and certain cities in California. But it is far more racially diverse than the places that you think that are all, you know, the rural New England and the Pacific Northwest. You know, I mean, people have pushed back more on the fact that in, and we were talking about that off air, but in blue states, often the rural areas are even more reactionary because they feel like they're totally occupied.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also some real grievances that I think that this stuff totally belies. For the past 10 years, the average life expectancy of people in these states who make under $90,000 a year has been declining.
Mm-hmm.
Like, people are dying younger. The net life gains are almost only to the wealthy. My other favorite thing is, like, well, New York and California could leave. And I'm like, well, okay, but if you... The industries that made you guys rich are either finance, tech, or rentier services. You don't actually produce that much outside of agriculture in California in specific, and everybody else can do that. Mm-hmm. And that's totally dependent on the U.S. dollar. So, no, you actually can't. If you were to do that, you would crash your own economy overnight. So, like, those kinds of attitudes just come off as smug and delusional.
Because they are, and it's like, it's classic liberalism right there, where it's like, there's no political economy included into it, right? It's mm-hmm. it's totally at the level of culture, right? And all these other people, they like hamburgers too much and country music too much, and that's why they're fucked up. It's not like an entire system of extraction and finance capital that is sort of depriving these areas of even what they mm-hmm. produce themselves.
And the national conservatives, I hate to say it, are speaking to that in a way that even the left kind of isn't. Bernie did in 2016, and he still kind of did in 2020. But because of his national profile and because he was seen as a Democrat by that point, it was harder for him to make the case, I think. I don't think that's the only postmortem to do there, but I think it's a real thing to admit that, like, he had a real appeal, and you know what liberals learned, you know what I hear they learned from this, is, oh, well, Bernie's real appeal is because Wisconsin former steelworkers are sexist.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. And, like, I will say one of the real shames about Bernie, both in 16 and 20, is that – having that political fight being waged within, not just with him running as a Democrat, but the fact that these fights were happening within the Democratic Party primary,
mm-hmm.
I think his true crossover appeal is sort of muted then, if you get what I mean. Like, so many states, they have closed primaries, right? I mean, I never got to vote for Bernie Sanders in a competitive election. Every time it was my turn, it was done. Right. Just saying, like, you know, like, to really look at, like, the possibility of the appeal of a Bernie Sanders, you know, in a general election kind of circumstance, I think it's something we should always remind ourselves of when we're doing postmortems of those two campaigns, that, like, there is that lost moment there, which I think would have been a really telling and probably the only real way to test the truth of the, you know, Bernie electability argument would have been seeing him general election against the Republican versus you know, having to fight with, you know, Clinton, who is, you know, uniquely attackable. 2020 was a whole different monster, frankly. But yeah, anyway, just, you know, I think it's important to remember when we're talking about his ability to pull over people who might be voting for the right, you know, he's sort of limited just because of the primary structure there.
I agree with you. I think it's interesting to think about the consequences of the mid-90s election reforms, which were designed to make sure a Ross Perot never happened again. Because we forget, Ross Perot got, like, what?
Matt wanted to be the center of attention.
14% of the vote at one point. Like, you know, the only third-party candidate before Ross Perot that had pulled those kinds of numbers was Teddy Roosevelt and Eugene Debs.
Mm-hmm.
And the last thing the Democrats or the Republicans wanted to risk was an early 20th century party realignment.
Mm-hmm.
And so state laws made it damn near impossible to run a third party. I mean, that's why, you know, you have like the Nader Quixote runs and whatnot. Mm-hmm. That was why that happened. And it's been a bind. I mean, it's put like the DSA in a near impossible bind because what do you do when you are shut out of any kind of viable politics beyond the municipal level. Well, one thing you could do is what the right is doing, actually, and that is take over small cities and school boards. But that would require a couple of things to change. Now, some of them maybe have changed a little bit since the pandemic and working remotely, and people being pushed out of the cities, finally, in a real big way. I mean, I think we are seeing some pretty big demographic shifts in population density that may have an effect, but so far that has not been a left-wing strategy at all. And one thing I will say that I know that you two probably won't agree with, but I think right now it's probably, well, maybe you agree with this in the way that I'll say it. I think right now it is more important to build an independent municipal level electoral base to start dismantling certain things that Republicans have done, for there to ever be the possibility of a viable left candidate. And right now, I think if the left, the far left doesn't do it, and because the Democratic brand is so toxic, on this city level, the way that the cities and states are controlled means that the Dems might be in the wilderness for 10 years and or more, and it's going to look like what happened to the Labor Party. And that's bad. Now, I think the Dems deserve it, but my sense of justice and my sense of like what I think is going to be good, since you have nothing, no viable left alternative. And the strategy, unfortunately, waged by the left in this tournament, it assumed two things. It assumed, one, that people of color were negative partisans almost solely. They were reacting to right-wing racists in the Democratic Party, and this would always, I mean, to the Republican Party, and this would always be loyal to the Democrats. Mm-hmm. Which I've always thought was an absurd argument. One of the things I used to say is like, look, if you're right, and we see just by raw numbers, economic diversity and educational diversity amongst people of color, there will be a larger diversity of voting patterns. There's like, now, unfortunately, because of the way the Democrats have done things, the number one predictor of Democratic voting is education level, and then the richness of the area you live in. Mm-hmm. Not your individual wealth, actually. So it is true that the aggregate richest counties in the United States are all Democratic strongholds, and they're all Democratic strongholds run by people in their 70s and 80s. Like, they don't have any real competition, and they don't need to. So right now, to talk about the theorization of this, the anti-systemic energy totally appears to be on the right, and they have multiple options now. You are no longer stuck with this demagogic Trumpism. If you're a Catholic intellectual, there's now a place for you. Mm-hmm. If you're a labor intellectual, there might be a place for you soon, particularly with this workers' dignity stuff. This stuff has been forgone by the left at their own peril. And I mean, I don't like, you know, I don't often talk about like the Latin America, although I lived in Mexico for a while. But one of the things that the Latin American left did was drop its historically justified opposition to the Catholic Church some, and started incorporating Catholic versions of solidarity and dignity into their rhetoric. In, for example, the Allende government and the Cardones, which are the workers' zones, workers' council zones, the more radical parties that were loyal to the Allende government wasn't the Communist Party. The Communist Party actually took a fairly conservative stance and all that, even though it was an Allende government ally in the Popular Unity government. It was the Christian socialist movements, which is historically weird, actually. Usually Christian socialist movements tend to be more moderate. They were the most radical form there. Not, you know, I'm not saying we should, I'm not saying we should like pretend to be all religious. I'm Jewish. I'm not going to have a whole lot of, you know, cachet with that. But what I will say, if you can't go to a black church and talk to people, if you can't go to a Catholic church and talk to people, because there's too many cultural limitations to your ability to interact with them, you're screwed. And I even mean this for like our trans comrades and whatnot. You have to speak in a way that makes people see your fight as their fight. And I do think the trans fight is about a lot more than just currently transitioning people are trans women in sports. Mm-hmm. I think it's about bodily autonomy and the right to self-agency, and that affects every single person. But we don't frame it like that. We frame it in a way that restricts people from that solidarity, not includes them. And the other thing I think a lot of the left is trying to do to kind of cut this strategy, these right-wing strategies off, is tailing conservative talking points and picking up conservative cultural points. I don't think that's not only do I think it's wrong, frankly, but I also think it's not going to work. Because one, if I'm a conservative, why the hell am I going to trust you? I'm just going to vote for the bigot I know is an actual bigot. And mm-hmm. two, it's going to alienate you from groups that are already on your side. So any growth that you will make will be at the cost of other people. You don't want that equation.
Yeah, no, that's a foolish strategy for sure.
But we see it. We see it right now. A lot of people think the way to cut off the right is to pick up right-wing talking.
Yeah, I see it. But frankly, the people I see it from are the people who are the furthest away from any kind of like real campaign or social movement strategy. I mean, to me, at least like the Compact Magazine people, et cetera, like those people feel very far away from like actual organizations or organizing social movements right now. I don't think that it's not something that exists and shouldn't be addressed, but I do think that like, I don't see this necessarily being the popular direction that a lot of the left is going. I do agree that like there is this real need to like reclaim things like solidarity and framing things in the way that you're talking about, where you're connecting all of these struggles, which I think a lot of people, and I think this comes primarily out of like an American political context to the dark ages of like the post-socialist left in this country, from like refusing to be able to frame things in that way. I totally agree with that.
Well, I'm not worried about this becoming a popular movement, these leftists trying to tail rightists.
Yeah.
But what I will say is what they function as is a block to trim people off.
I think they definitely do that. I would agree with that. Yeah.
And to get people not involved in campaigning that they otherwise would be involved in. They're not a motivator. They are a demotivator.
Totally.
Now, Compact Magazine is more complicated than that because I frankly don't think it's for us.
No,
I think it's part of this whole intellectual, ideological justification mechanism for saying that, like, look, there is now an ideology that's more than Trump, that's more than just anti-political rage and QAnon. Mm-hmm. It's so that there's an intellectual class and a hegemonic ideological justification for what's going on. It's not for mass movement. To be frank, most of our publications aren't for mass movement either. Mm-hmm. We are ideological or informational or educational, depending on what level you're working at, shoring up so people have things that they can use, right? Mm-hmm. And we give them the justification to do those things. Mm-hmm. But we're not doing those things. Like, I do. I'm a union member, so I, you know, and I'm sure everyone here does organizing. But that's not what we're doing right now. Like, and mm-hmm. I think that's also crucial to point out. It's hard to know how much effect that's going to have, with the exception that a lot of people that I think used to be attracted to more left-wing causes in their disillusionment in the mid-aught teens are not coming to us anymore. Mm-hmm. And you are seeing things like the DSA increasingly, and I'm not picking on the DSA just to pick on the DSA, but the DSA increasingly looks like its core constituencies is the five boroughs of New York, New Jersey, the Bay Area, Portland, and Seattle. And there was that was not true before 2020. All right. That was always going to be the stronghold because that's the progressive stronghold, and that's where it's the easiest to get more actual working class people because you're not fighting a culture war and a bunch of other things. But I saw real growth in places like New Orleans and Salt Lake and in Atlanta and Athens, Georgia, and stuff like that. I'm not seeing that anymore. And I think that is because we did not know how to deal with the COVID situation and what happened to the unions during COVID, which all happened very quietly. It's the thing, like, I feel very good about the Starbucks and Amazon unionization efforts, and more power to them. I'm not crapping on them. But one of the things that we have to realize about the rights advantage right now is that traditional union membership saw a brief increase from 2012 to about 2019. All those increases were undone in a year plus some.
Mm-hmm. And like here in Texas, a pretty protracted war on existing unions. I mean, I will say the stuff that's being done here with the DSA in Texas has been pretty pretty incredible. And like that power in organizing is just continuing to grow. But I mean, I definitely would agree with the idea that like part, and you know, this is a big part of what we do here at Left Reckoning is trying to cover, you know, struggles in the South and the West at large. You know, there has been a kind of muted growth over the past couple of years, because I think a lot of people, even apart from people who are absorbing socialist ideas or might be encouraged to join, I mean, I think a lot of people are saying we did something via Bernie. It didn't work out. You know, politics is not the best way for me to spend a Saturday afternoon if the world's going to end. And
yeah,
you know,
I mean,
our friend Ronan Burtonshaw, who's editor of Tribune in the UK, has a good line. He's like, you know, one of the big challenges that the socialist left has to do on top of all like the practical organizational stuff is actually being able to convince people that engaging in politics can change their lives for the better. And the better part is the kicker there, because I talk to people all the time, and you know, my neighborhood, my community, and you know, they like a lot of the things that we talk about. But you know, talk to them about maybe joining up or doing something. They're like, "Well, I'm not doing that because that's not going to happen." You know, like actually achieving victory. And I think you know, moving. We certainly are in a demobilizing phase, and we have to like ratchet up our ability to recruit and grow again, particularly in the South. And they, yeah, I don't know. I mean, the DSA stuff internally is a whole other conversation.
Yeah, but I mean, it's not in the purview of this conversation. I will say though that the numbers back not just slow growth, but about 20,000 expired memberships. Now, they haven't left, but so they're still reactivatable. But it's a real concern, and I do think we have to be careful when we generalize about the DSA because it's so federated. Mm-hmm. That
absolutely.
like I love the DSA in New Orleans. Love them deaf. I go down there and work with them, you know, whenever I can get to New Orleans. You know, I don't always love
with was
my
local
chapter. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's interesting too, because you can't, a lot of people like, oh, well, you know, some of the most radical DSAs are actually in the South, the Midwest, and the West because like, if you're going to be any kind of socialist down there, you might as well go all the way, right?
Like, yeah, you're not going to get like a nice job, you know, three, 4 years later. Yeah.
Yeah, right. It's not a resume patter.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're not getting hired at a nice NGO, and no one's going to hire you for Think Progress, and even though there's a Democratic governor in Louisiana, you got no political advantages. So yeah, like
Edwards is
right.
Yeah.
So, you know, and you know what I tell people to do is like go if you can join a union, because there's been a conservatization of unions too. And it's actually ironic why in a lot of public sector unions, there is three levels. There's a national level, which is fairly affordable to join. There's a state level and the local level. And the state level is also usually fairly affordable to join. Economies of scale. But the local level fees and the administrative fees for that can be quite high. And so one of the things that's happening in a lot of teachers unions, and particularly in teachers unions where the union's national membership seems to be pretty heavily Democratic Party operatives, frankly, particularly in the NEA, but some type in the AFT too. There's a lot of resistance because the highest levels of union penetration are in rural areas because it's cheaper to get a membership because the administrative fees are lower. So we've seen a conservatization of the unions. Now, the Utah Teachers Union used to be one of the most militant in the country. All right. They had really knocked down, drag out, brutal strikes in the 80s. And they weren't good democratic liberals. I mean, we're talking about Mormons, you know, but they would fight for their own immediate material interest. The issue that we had lately and how there's been a conservatization of the union is that the material interest during COVID didn't seem clear. Like, rural schools were not, it's not just that rural schools were full of anti-vaxxers. It's also that their population is lower and they're not as affected. Like, this is something I don't hear people talking that much about, but like, that's part of why there's a different attitude. Population density really matters for a semi-airborne virus. So, their needs were not the needs of the cities, and they were at odds with each other. And even though the city unions have a teacher base that's much larger, they actually end up being about 50-50. So the union was just torn on doing anything. Now, that's not true in every state, but that in a lot of states, that's been happening for a while. And the unions have been seeing, their leadership have been seeing as being Democratic Party lobbyist operatives for the most part. And so there's been less and less engagement or even active hostility from union members on, and it's been breaking down union solidarity. What's interesting is that's a reversal of a trend that because of the Republican attacks on these like Midwestern and Western unions. I mean, in the South, the unions were crushed in the 20s. So like that hasn't been the same thing. But you think about the West Virginia, like wildcat teacher strike, right? Like that had broad bipartisan support among teachers.
Totally.
And so what you saw in the aught teens was a coming closer together of this sector. Yes, it's credentialed. Yes, it might be even labor aristocratic, but of labor coming together to do something. And what COVID has really kind of done and the way it's been particularly handled by both parties has undone a lot of that solidarity. The urban and rural schools are more at odds than they've ever been. Their needs are very different, and both of them are hemorrhaging workers like it's no tomorrow. So a lot of other unions have similar patterns. And so I think the thing that the national conservatives may do is they're going to try to stop the Republican explicit hostility to the unions. So that they can penetrate more, particularly into those areas where there's rural union members who on labor are probably really good, strong people actually, and you'd want them on your side, but on cultural issues can go in either direction. And if it looks like you're pitting them against a bunch of liberals in DC, they're not going to help you. And if you have a Republican opposition base or a Republican ideology that now says, well, as long as the unions don't get too uppity, we're for them again.
Yeah. No, it could be. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot, you know, I mean, all these fights really end up, all these questions really do end up bringing us back to the question of trying to revitalize and reorient ourselves towards labor. See Derek Varn. You can find his work on Varn Vlog. Sublation magazine has a new piece out. And yeah, man, we really enjoyed hanging out with you this afternoon.
Yeah, great stuff.